ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just one day after Jack McLennan's relationship fell apart, he vanished.
I couldn't believe this was happening.
Immediately, accusations started flying.
You need to cough up and you need to confess.
But it soon became clear there was so much more to the story.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, Geraldine Doogue here. Last week, Hamish McDonald and I were privileged to talk to two of the best foreign correspondents going at the Sydney Writers' Festival. We spoke with the former bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times in Beijing and Seoul, Barbara Demick. And we spoke with the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, about their recent memoirs, Daughters of the Bamboo Groves and The Finest Hotel in Kabul. Look, I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. I want to ask you first, Lise, how is there still a big appetite in this world where so much is happening and people, there are elements of overload, but also elements of, you know, constant breaking news, breaking news, breaking news. Is there a good appetite still for news from places far from people's comfortable lounge rooms?
Is that a very elegant Australian way to say, Lise, are you about to be unemployed? I'm not the first person to say it, but I think it's been clear to all of us for a very long time that international news is not foreign news. I think we have been, the message has been sent to us loudly, clearly, and sometimes very painfully, that crises which seem far away are not far away at all, and the borders that we once thought of, and of course, if you're in Australia, you seem very far away, but look, the climate crisis is truly global. What happened in the pandemic was truly global. Migration crisis, truly global. Even in Australia, you're very far away. I'm a Canadian citizen, I'm a Canadian national. I have indefinite leave to remain in Britain. and you know, people come to our shores as well. So, you know, what happens in Syria, in Afghanistan, is not, my aunts used to talk about, oh, Lise, why do you go to those countries? Well, those countries sitting in the desks next to your children in school. They're shopping in the same markets. They're doctors in your hospitals. So I would like to say that those countries which seem far away and distant in every way are not distant at all. What would you say, Barbara? Would you?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, not only is there a larger appetite, I think, for international news, but what we write, broadcast is consumed all over the world. When I started out covering foreign affairs in the 1990s, people would, you know, send me letters through the post that would come from the U.S. to Berlin, where I was living at the time. And now, you know, I get these emails and text messages, some of them a little bit abusive, but, you know, people are reading, and it's this small world. So I think these are actually great times to be a foreign correspondent.
So your foreign desks, you know, the classic story of the poor old correspondent out in the field, and you can tell your own story, Hamish, who has to then persuade the foreign desk. He says, "Oh, I don't know," you know. Like, I mean, do you find that you're on song with the people who are, they're the gatekeepers in many ways, aren't they?
What correspondent anywhere in the world is on song with the news desk?
Yeah.
Geraldine.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, but I think we should, journalists and journalism comes in all shapes and sizes, and I'm very fortunate that I work for a global broadcaster, radio, television, online, social media, and so therefore international news is part of our stock and trade. Of course, for our UK outlets, sometimes it is a battle. Just randomly, if the prime minister is about to lose his job or her job, then of course that's going to be the news that will displace all other news. And also, to our great frustration, and I speak partly here as a Canadian, every time President Trump opens his mouth, it goes right up to the top of the news. And I have to say that when we were waiting for his inauguration the second time. We had an editor's meeting. I'm considered an on-air editor. And I thought, do I say to colleagues, do I say, listen, every time President Trump speaks, we shouldn't just automatically put it to the top of the news? And I thought, do I say this? And I thought, no, let's just wait and see. But the problem is that in his second term, that it's not what he says, it's actually what he does. And the president and commander-in-chief who came into office vowing he was going to be the unifier, the man who doesn't start wars but stops them, has been, well, he says, ended at last count, I think it was 9, up for you to judge, good citizens of the Sydney Writers Festival. But, like, for example, this latest one, and here's an example of what I was saying. I was in Barbarossa as well. We were in New Zealand, sorry to mention. Oh, I shouldn't have mentioned this. Can you cut this out? That way, can you cut this out?
We went to New Zealand. It's definitely going
to
stay.
Yeah, we shouldn't say. We should have said we came to Australia first, and then we came to New Zealand. But anyway, we had to go to New Zealand first. But the impact of this crisis in the Strait of Hormuz, if countries worldwide are affected about it. It's not just a crisis in the... So that also is getting in the way of fighting with editors about what should be the top story.
Barbara, I'm interested in your take on this reporting to American audiences, because, you know, even though America's power might be waning, its influence on global events is outsized. For a time, I worked for an American network, and I just found the desire for understanding of the nuance of the world was just absent. You know, in Iraq during the rise of ISIS, you know, you're writing a story about, you know, Sunni and Shia and the complexities and what the dynamic is in Mosul, and the feedback is, just talk about the fight against the bad guys.
Well, I'm sure most of the people in the Trump administration don't know the difference between the Sunnis and the Shias, which is part of the problem we're having. Americans, you know, can be very checked out, and we don't think that they're in the center of the world and they don't need to pay attention. So we have to work harder. But I think in general, I agree with Lise, there's more foreign news is more relevant to people's lives in terms of who their neighbors are, in terms of who the immigrants are, in terms of their gasoline prices, which is a big issue right now. I mean, I think the problem is not the news itself. I think people are consuming more foreign news. It's just that they're not paying for it. You know, they're getting it. It's frankly stolen by the social media companies. And, you know, they take our stuff. And, you know, at some point at the bottom of the food chain, there is a reporter, a journalist who's there, presumably witnessing and writing about it. But then, you know, the information is taken off of social media, you know, regurgitated by a lot of news sites that, you know, are really just copying.
We're going to ask Lise to take us to Kabul. You're going to take us to China and North Asia. But I wonder if it's worth letting the audience in on something we've just learned, which is that you were neighbors at a certain point. Where and when and why?
Yeah, I still remember we lived on, I lived up the hill and you lived down the hill.
Yeah.
We lived in an area called Masrara in Jerusalem.
Yeah, we lived in a sort of a spot near the Green Line that was, you know, kind of a little bit mixed and had, you know, artists and journalists, and unfortunately has been taken over by religious fanatics. But we were neighbors. I think we met in maybe 94, 95.
Yeah. Immediate aftermath of the Oslo Accords, where there was a yearning for peace, where people believed there was a possibility for Israelis and Palestinians to find ways to live together, where people used the word peace. And of course, now the words are, the language is very different. But it was a very heady time. And I think we would call it almost golden years of journalism.
Yeah. And global years of Middle East.
Yes.
Optimism. Because, I mean, there was, well, I don't know, do we really want to talk about the Middle East?
No.
Maybe not. But our neighborhood was quite mixed. Hmm. And, you know, it was just very different.
And can I just, because in this book, you talk about one of the unsuspected byproducts of the times in Afghanistan was the Intercontinental Hotel, was the way everybody mixed. And you'd have Soviet diplomats and Americans, and I think Israelis. You'd have a whole range of people all coming for fabulous events, all enjoying each other's company, because this was, a sort of a moment of possibility. So there are times, aren't there, when you have extraordinary interchange, and it's tragic that that doesn't get capitalised upon, isn't it?
I was searching to find some kind of familiar prism to tell what is, for quite a few people, perhaps an unfamiliar story or not familiar enough story, which is why I chose the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul. I was looking for an iconic building where enough history went through it so you could tell it through that house. And of course, I know it's Australia. Why would you ever want to take a holiday if you live in the most beautiful country in the world? But all of us love hotels. And let's be honest, a luxury hotel. And it was it was built in 1969 when Afghanistan was a kingdom. So it was a time with bikinis by the swimming pool, cocktails on the roof, escargot. And of course, it was a rarefied world. It was at the time when Afghanistan had a mild-mannered king who wanted to see this hotel as the modernization of Afghanistan. But in that hotel, even though only the rich could go there and foreigners, was all of Afghanistan, all different social classes, all different ethnic groups and tribes. And so, and I was able to tell the arc of 50 years of history through the prism of this building, because when the Soviet tanks rumbled into Kabul in Christmas of 1979, the Intercontinental train pulled out. So it became a government hotel, which meant that whenever the rulers changed in Afghanistan, the rules of the hotel changed. And I've always been struck about how Afghans have had to live through possibly every political system that the world has tried. There was a kingdom, Soviet-backed communism, there was warlordism, there was Islamism in the Taliban, there was would-be democracy bankrolled by the West, and now again it's Taliban and Islamism again. And all that history swirled around the hotel and right inside of it.
And yes, you end up telling a great history, and so do you, Barbara, because you make the point in this, I became totally enthralled with Daughters of the Bamboo Grove, that until World War II, there was very little international adoption. It was something that was extremely rare. Then it became, we learned a lot about it. And I think the first baby was 2002. I think a friend of yours adopted a baby from China. And then you go through, by 2009, 100,000 babies had been exported. You even used that word.
That's how the Chinese
talked about it, from China. And then I think in 2004, I think I've got the time right, they actually decided this was not something that they wanted to own, exporting their babies. You know, there was this sort of extraordinary wave of change coming right through.
Yeah.
And you decide to focus on these two little girls. And I wonder if you can summarise how you were drawn into this story. It's such a powerful story.
Well, thank you so much. You know, we've been talking about sort of the small world and, you know, gas prices and your immigrant neighbours, but international adoption was another way in which the world is small. And my book really focuses on these identical twins. One is Chinese, one is American. The American one was adopted. It was actually stolen for adoption.
Snatched away from her family.
But the book is really about, besides this immediate case, baby girls who were confiscated by Chinese government officials for this very lucrative adoption market. And one of them was this identical twin. My work as a foreign correspondent is quite different from Lee's. You do everything now. You can do a very sensitive book that builds empathy, and you can do breaking news. I have not done as much breaking news in my career. I worked for smaller news organizations, and so there was always this sense of, you know, you have to find a story that's different. The wires or the BBC will cover the big breaking headlines. So I've always been sort of sniffing around the edges and kind of stealthy.
I wonder, though, what you think of the value of the human story within the big picture, right? Because you both, in your own ways, do tell human stories. And I can think of so many examples, Lise, of stories where you've found the little human story in the bigger thing. And this is something Gerry and I often debate about. You know, Geraldine's incredibly interested in the big ideas, and I want the human bit, maybe from having been a correspondent. Mm-hmm. So what's the value of these little human snapshots from the other side of the world?
I mean, it's building empathy. And, you know, you were sort of challenging us, or me, on do Americans care about others? And, you know, maybe not so much, but, you know, you have to work very hard to create that sense of empathy and to put your reader or your listener into the sense of, like, what would you do if you were in this situation? What would you do if you were a poor, powerless, uneducated Chinese villager and the government came and took your baby and said, you have no right to complain? You know, what would you do? You'd fight, but, you know, maybe you wouldn't fight that hard if you lived in this kind of totalitarian society.
This episode of Global Roaming Live with me, Geraldine Doogue, and Hamish McDonald was recorded at the Sydney Writers' Festival with foreign correspondents Barbara Demick and Lise Doucette.
I wonder if, Lise, you think the human story, though, still has the capacity to really have impact. Like, thinking back to the way the world reacted to the BBC's reporting of famine in Africa, right, and then leading to this kind of reaction and Live Aid and all the rest of it. That was an example where some images of a starving child woke the world up to an issue that it hadn't really been focused on. Can that, in this very conflicted world full of mis and disinformation, can an image, can a human story that you find or anyone else finds really change the course of things?
You really want us to be unemployed, don't you? While I listen to the question, my mind is thinking, yes, it has become more difficult. Yes, the relationship between the amount of noise and the amount of signal, the story which cuts through all the noise, has become more and more difficult. But I cannot say that it's not possible, because it is to deny our belief, because this is why we do what we do. We have to believe that we live in a world where we haven't lost our capacity to care for those beyond our own home, our own street, because of the interconnectedness of our world. Barbara used the word empathy, and I think it isn't important. We have to care about what is happening not far from us. For example, my book was about Afghanistan. Can I challenge anyone here in this room to accept that we live in a world in 2026 where there is a country where girls cannot be educated beyond grade 6, where women cannot go to university, and many jobs are denied to women? Of course, you may be thinking, yes, well, Lise, well, then what can I do? And sometimes the what can I do is simply, well, just, you know, the answer is in your pocket. I mean, we have no excuses now. If we can choose not to know about it, to care about it. And of course, there's so many places that we could care about. We can't care about all of them, and we make choices. And some of us care about what's happening across the street. Some of us care what's happening across the country. But I think we all choose, you know, what is it? Because we are, you know, our hearts and our time are only so big. But I always see it as a challenge. When I see journalism students, I say that journalism is now in an existential crisis, and that journalism is going to live or die in their generation. And I think it is a challenge for us. I think Barbara would agree that to get better at what we do, to try to break through, it's not easy, and technology is making it ever harder, and the politics is making it ever harder, and the pressures on people's lives are, it's really hard for your heart to be big when your own heart is broken, because your own life is so difficult. And I think I'm not going to minimize the difficulties, but I'm also not going to sit here and say, you know, let's give up the fight.
There's one thing I disagree with you
about,
and that's we have to get better, because we're already damn good, especially you.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean,
I think we do have to get better.
I think it has a lot to do with the business structure and what you know, what I saw at various failed and failing newspapers that I've worked for is they're always looking for, we need more local, we need more this, we need more news you can use. But I mean, really a lot of the problems are on the business side. When advertising went online, I mean, we had, I guess it started with Craigslist in the US. Newspapers, you know, relied on advertising. The advertising went online. Then the tech companies started taking our content. And, you know, I see, yes, I mean, we should always get better, but I don't think the problem is with the content providers. It's with the industry. And, it, you know, it's with people who don't want to pay for the news. And I can't say to you, you know, you should subscribe to this or that newspaper when you can get the content for free online, but you know, why can you get it for free online? You know, where's the support for journalism?
Can we do a little case study? When we first met tonight, you said your program was one day a week,
and then it's moved,
and now it's 5 days a week. How many people here listen to Global Roaming?
Wow!
How many of you were glad when it went to 5 days a week? Thank you.
Okay.
I rest my case.
Yeah. Captive audience.
Well, yeah. Yes,
good
lovely.
For you.
Terrifically representative audience.
Yeah.
Look, I wasn't sure, to be candid, that there would be that appetite because.
Oh my God, the meetings.
You know, just because there's such a domestic focus, and I understand why. You know, the water cooler conversations. That was always my dream. You know, that we make this the water cooler conversation, and I think we have more. But like the Ukraine war is a very interesting example.
Oh, there, it's a good example.
Now, I've thought, just think as you're both speaking. Now, I watched you on those first days, Lise, in Kyiv, or as you had us Kyiv. I thought, all right, okay, Lise says Kyiv. I've always said Kyiv. But, and you were there as the tanks were, well, it looked like they were going to roll down the hill, and then it didn't happen. Now, you, God, you were just, you said hours on that, and I remember. And now, as that 4 years have gone on, it's very interesting to me to work out what are the human stories that have cut through and what haven't. You know, when I watch the correspondence from all matter of ABC and a whole lot of people, and the skill in finding a way to make a story human, that is a really, that is a skill, I think. I mean, you must have done this, Hamish. You must have thought a lot about this in your own work.
But I also hope we can, just in having this conversation, also ask why so many people are losing trust in us. I don't want this to be totally self-congratulatory. You're amazing, both of you. I trust
you. Do you think so?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes.
But
yes. No,
there's
but
a very significant portion of society that will now happily say, don't trust a word you say. ABC, why don't you call it as it is? How do you put all of that together?
This is all part of the challenge, because we live in a time where people feel that not only can they have their own opinions, they can have their own facts. And unfortunately, the facts are the facts. And it is a battle. It is a battle for truth. And I know that sounds very lofty. And it is a battle for trust. And it is a battle that we are fighting, and I would be the first to admit it, that we are now called mainstream media, MSM, and that's not a compliment, or legacy media, which almost makes it sound as though we belong in a dusty museum. But then I think it's also swings and roundabouts. There are some polls which say that, yes, people, you know, pulled away by social media. And of course, we live in a time where we have this paradox where never have we had so much information, but also never have we had so much misinformation and disinformation, and artificial intelligence, the rise, is now blurring the lines between fake and fact, and making our job and your job ever more difficult. So we are fighting for audiences. We feel that at the BBC. So We just have to keep trying.
Your outgoing boss, Deborah Ternes at the BBC, made quite a big speech last week.
About content creators.
Yes, where she basically said the big institutions like the BBC or the ABC almost need to strip themselves down and think about how they actually compete against Joe Rogan and the rest is politics, and maybe kind of take out the structures, if you like, of traditional newsrooms and big media institutions and be more direct, make it more about the personalities like Lise Doucette. What do you think about her arguments?
Funny, she didn't say that when she was at the BBC, when she resigned under pressure. There is this, you know, and we resist it now. We call it content now rather than calling it news, and we make jokes about it. And but it is true that the way, you know, back to your point about technology is changing the way we live, the way we consume news, the way we make news, and more people are listening to podcasts. People are going to Instagram. We now have to do social videos, and there's more of, and it's something that journalists of my generation resist, this face to camera, where journalists speak directly to the camera, and it's a sort of like a short minute where they talk about the news and it's more chatty and casual. Podcasting, of course, is a more informal kind of conversation. I'm still a linear journalist in the sense of it's pathetic, actually. I wait 2 minutes to six. I've got to watch the news, and I wait 2 minutes. Okay, you know, I can go later online, but I'm so fixed on the clock. You know, I'm so traditional. I don't know. I don't know whether other people here are like that. Any linear here?
Yeah.
Please tell me I'm not like. Oh. But more and more people don't want have an appointment to view. They want to listen to it when they want to listen to. Habits are changing, tastes are changing, and certainly among the younger generation. So I think the responsibility on all of us, and I can only speak for I work for the BBC, where for us it's existential because there's a license fee, and more people are not paying the license fee. We have to remain relevant in people's lives. But the Ukraine, also, the last thing I will say was interesting. When the news matters, the statistics and the evidence is that people come back
exactly
to mainstream media.
Exactly.
You know, all of the figures, when there was that full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine, more people came to, and please say whether it happened at the ABC as well, more people came to BBC Radio, BBC Television, more traditional media, that they trusted it when it mattered.
When we had the big fires, that we just, you know, our numbers just go like that.
This is it,
because they do trust us.
Yes.
But yeah, it is a matter of trust. And I'm not like you. I'm not linear. I don't watch the news at 6 p.m. I spent an embarrassingly long amount of time on social media looking at news. And, you know, the thing about social media is that the news is there first, but it's often not true. Because they'll, you know, as soon as there's a rumor that there was a shooting or there was a this or a that, you know, it will go on social media. And so, you know, I think the public, especially the young public, needs to be educated that, okay, you could see it there first, but when I see something shocking first on social media, then I look at the BBC, I look at the New York Times site to see if it's actually true.
Well, and
I
think great old line, wasn't it, that used to be, you know, better to be first and wrong rather than second and right. You know, that was and the legacy media very much said, we'll be second and right. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah. And but others didn't care. Not wrong for long. Yeah.
But you can do both as news consumers. And I mean, I feel like, I mean, I'm a book writer now, but that we're more relevant than ever, that you're more relevant than
really
ever.
It's really important. And of course, there's the other phrase too, the story that's too good to check.
Yeah. don't let the facts get in the way of a good story. There was at Columbia Journalism School, they used to have that t-shirt. It was, you know, a joke, but I think a lot of people believe it.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Would you please put your hands together for Barbara and Felix?
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.